This is an oral history interview with Professor William Hackton of the School of the Department of Mass Communication, retired for a couple of decades. It is the 25th of February, 2013. Bill, let's start off with your family background, where you grew up, early influences. Was there anything about either your parental influences or schools you attended or particular teachers that help explain your future career trajectory?
Well, my father's family were German immigrants, and the family all grew up in Omaha, my father was went to work at the age of 12 in a packing house in Omaha, and he later became a cattle buyer, and as a result of that work, he eventually brought the family to Los Angeles, and that's where I essentially grew up. That he came to Los Angeles about 1928, and then I lived in Los Angeles the rest of my growing up and going to school there too, and so the one influence that I think was probably important was the fact that my uncle, my father's younger brother, was a newspaper man, pretty highly placed reporter and editor for Hearst newspapers, and lived in Washington D.C. and we would get the Los Angeles Examiner and see his byline on the front pages and so forth, and then once in a while he would visit us in California, and he was kind of a glamorous figure, you know, a national journalist, and so I had an early desire to go into journalism, and that really kind of stayed with me all the way for quite a while, and I really went into a journalism career before several years and well into one before I decided to change to academia.
You then went to Stanford University for your undergraduate career. I don't know if Stanford was as competitive in terms of entry requirements at that time as it now is, but it certainly speaks well for your high school record.
Well, yeah, here is where football came in. I played high school football, and I was pretty good at high school football. And Huntington Park was very close to USC, and there was a football scholarship for the asking to go to USC. I mean, they would take me, but I decided I didn't want to go to USC, which had a very low academic reputation at the time, and so I made an effort to get into Stanford, and I did. I got they gave you a grant in aid. They essentially paid your tuition for the freshman year, which was I think $250 a quarter, but that was a lot of money at that time because the Depression was still on, and so then also I got a. They would give you a hashing job, what they said, that you if you were on the football team, you got a chance to work as in the food service in the commons and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I got in, and Stanford was a lot easier to get into in those days, certainly, and it was also hard to flunk out. So, you know, that as long as you would pay the tuition, they would just keep you there. You know, and they had the, I don't know, this is sort of an incidental thing, but they used to have what they called a ball out, which was a directory they put out every semester, every quarter, mm-hmm. and where you listed everybody's name and address and location, plus a grade point average, mm-hmm. and the number of how long you'd been in and how many credits you had, and you had to get a certain amount of credits before you could ever graduate, and some people just went on and on, and so that they were very tolerant, but you know, it was still a kind of a poor university at the time. They didn't really have much money. Most of their money had been in the Southern Pacific Railroad, and the railroads were doing terribly in the 1930s, and Stanford was really in bad shape. But the standards were very good, and that's something I appreciated later. And you had some. And they had the stimulation of a lot of smart people, and so that was a big help to getting me started on that.
Well, you started your Stanford career during the war years, and yeah. then you had to interrupt your university work for military service.
Well, yes, you signed up for reserve. In the fall of 42, I guess it was, they were just about to make the draft very universal, and so everybody was scrambling to get into reserves, and I got into the B-12 reserve, which was both Navy and Marine Corps, but it was a kind of a peculiar thing. You were actually in the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps, and I had the uniform, and we had a unit at the University of at Berkeley. Stanford did not have a unit, did not have any of these reserve units, because the president Ray Lyman Wilbur had very loudly proclaimed beforehand that he didn't think any college students should be drafted, and so as a result, Stanford did not get any reserve programs. So all of us were sent to UC Berkeley. So I was in the Marine Corps, but I in the Marine Corps stationed at Berkeley for, it turns out, 4 semesters, and then. Because I was just a sophomore, I entered as a sophomore, I had longer time to stay, because at the end of each semester, they would take the advanced class, the farthest advanced, and then send them off to either Marine boot camp or the Navy basic training. At Berkeley, you could take whatever you wanted. You could take any courses you wanted. The only thing that was required to take was physics, and for some reason they thought physics was so everybody had to take physics, and this was a tough physics class. It was the regular one that Berkeley had, and it was the only one they had, and so everybody scrambled for that, And if you flunked any courses, you were supposed to go to. They sent you to San Diego for boot camp, you know, for either Marines or the Navy, and the physics class was the big problem, and we were and most of us did it, had no inclination to study physics decided at the end of the course that he just gave everybody in the class a C, everyone. But anyway, it was I had, but it was four semesters of very interesting work. The classes were small. The civilian enrollments were down, and I studied. I majored in philosophy, just because there was no journalism available at Berkeley. So I thought, well, I'll take philosophy. I was interested in philosophy, and they had some great philosophy professors there, and I took these courses and enjoyed them a lot. But I never would have never really entertained majoring in it. After the four semesters, I was sent into Marine Corps training. And for about a year, and I went through the training and was commissioned a second lieutenant in early, I think it was about July 4th, 1945, and then I was sent to Camp Pendleton, California, and at that time there were about 300 second lieutenants. All of us in this boot camp too at Camp Pendleton, I remember it very well, and we were not attached to any troops or anything, and then I learned afterwards that the whole group of us were assigned to be replacements after the initial landings in Japan, and at the time they were planning the invasion. In fact, Dave Cronin was in a similar situation with an army unit, I think in the Philippines, they were getting ready to invade Japan, and then the bomb went off, and then I got out of it.
So then you went back to Stanford to complete your undergraduate work.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then I had enough from... In one year I completed the... the B.A. degree at Stanford, so I got a B.A. in 1947.
And you continued your football career as well.
That's right. And I, at that time, I was I had played at Stanford. I'd played at Berkeley. I had played at Berkeley on both seasons there, and then I came back to Stanford, and then we played Cal again, and there were seven of us from Stanford who played on Berkeley, and then came back afterwards, and then back at Stanford, and then beat Berkeley.
Then I gather you had a temporary career in the National Football League.
Yes, that's right. I was drafted by the New York Giants, and it seemed that the contract was $6,000 plus $1,500 as a bonus for signing. And at the time, there was another league that was challenging the NFL, and so they were playing. That was considered a pretty good salary, and it was in those days. I mean, for me, it was a lot of money. And I remember our coach, the coach at Stanford, Marty Schwartz, had said, "This is just too much money for him to pass up." You know, and he. So that was
a brief career, however.
Yeah, that's right. Just one year of playing, and then I came back a second year, and through the training camp, which is about a month or so, and then at the end of that training camp, I was cut from the squad, and so at that time I was very unhappy, and I was first as the only job I ever lost, but I subsequently was glad I did get out at that time, and then I started, at Stanford, the chairman, Chick Bush, who was from Wisconsin, and was a fine man. Chick Bush got me on a job at Small Daily in Santa Paula, California, and that was my first newspaper job. So
when you began that job, you had no particular plans for further graduate work?
No, not at all.
But not too long afterwards, you went to UCLA for an MS program?
Yeah, right. Let me just back up on that a little bit. I had after about 2 years at Santa Paula, a college friend and I did a bicycle trip, through Europe for about 8 months, and we literally just rode bicycles. And it's amazing that we did this. And but we were both very much taken by Europe, and I really developed a real interest in European affairs and
not yet African affairs, though.
No, not African. And but it it really gave me a very much of a international outlook on from my life thereon. And,
what kinds of beats that you have as a journalist?
Well, I was mostly as a reporter and. And that was at Santa Paula. Then later, I started working on larger papers, including the Long Beach Press Telegram, and then also the Los Angeles Examiner, which was, along with the L.A. Times, were the two big newspapers in Los Angeles. And then I was told that the best way up in newspaper work is through copy desk or through the desk, mm-hmm. rather than as a reporter, mm-hmm. And so I was decided I was work that way. I was and I worked on copy desks at, both on a couple of the papers, Examiner and the Santa Monica Outlook, and then later when I went back to Minnesota, I worked on the Minneapolis. Star and the copy desk.
Mm-hmm. And in between, you did the MS degree at UCLA?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That was in journalism?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Harba was on the faculty at UCLA.
Oh, she was.
Yeah.
Is that how you met?
Yeah, that's right.
And she later became your wife?
That's right. And she was a Stanford graduate, but she was a couple years earlier because she wasn't affected by the of course by the draft, and but we had not known each other at Stanford, but we were married in 1952, and I was still intending to follow a journalism career, but then I began to believe that newspaper salaries are never very good, and you're supposed to do it because you enjoy doing it, and I could see the problem with journalism that there's not very many good jobs on the top. It's more like a pyramid organization. And many good journalists get out after about 10-15 years and go into public relations or mm-hmm. whatever. Whereas the whole field of mass communication theory was really beginning to take hold, mm-hmm. There were only a few schools that were really involved in it, and those were Stanford, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and then Iowa to a certain extent, and they were beginning to offer PhD programs in mass communication,
So this sought to give more of a social science orientation.
Yes,
to,
very much so. Mm-hmm.
Journalism, which in earlier times had been essentially. Vocational isn't the right word, but focused on the professional requirements
of
journalism per se.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people that, Blyer, who was a longtime journalism professor at Wisconsin, and the man who had great influence on the field, Willard Blyer, and had trained many of the top people, such as Bush at Stanford and Ralph Casey at Minnesota, mm-hmm. and who were outstanding people in the field, and particularly in the new field, and so that So social science research was beginning to be incorporated more and more into the field. And
So then you started doctoral study at University of Minnesota,
right?
And were, while you were also working as a copy editor, or those were summer.
That was just summer employment. Positions. Yeah, I was working. I had decided to go into journalism teaching, academic work, and we had we'd gone up and talked to Bush at Stanford, and the program there was highly quantitative and very great deal of statistics and so forth, whereas he recommended that the Minnesota program would be more in my own interest, that it was more involved with history and law and those aspects, so that we went to Minnesota instead of Stanford, and then stayed in the Midwest so that when I finished at the Minnesota, my job, the first job, I got a job at Wisconsin. And it's interesting that this, interesting the way I was hired. This would have been about, when was that?
1959.
Yeah, that's right. About 1959.
You were still ABD at the time.
That's right. That's right. I did not have, and I came as a, an instructor for 2 years. And, but the thing of it was, my advisor at Minnesota, Ray Nixon, who was an international teacher, international specialist, he called Ralph Nafziger, who was the director here, and says, "I have a good guy," Ralph invited me down and introduced me, and I met the dean of LNS. I forget his name now.
Ingram.
Yeah,
Mark
Ingram. Mark Ingram. Yeah, that's right. He always made a point of meeting every new candidate. The thing of it was, there was no search committee. It was just that Ray Nixon and Ralph Nafziger had thought that I would be a good person, and I never had a contract. All I ever had was a letter, which was typed by Ralph himself, and that asked me to join and given me listing the salary and so forth. And the rest of the colleagues had nothing to say about this. But it was a good way of doing it. It was sort of like the smoke-filled room instead of the primaries, then the university started changing a lot after that,
Now, when you came, had you already developed the interest in developing areas, or Africa in particular?
No, I didn't. The way I got into African studies was the fact that I, because of my European travel and some coursework at Minnesota, I became much more interested in international aspects of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get into that as a teaching area. But Ralph Nafziger was about 3 years from retirement, and he was teaching the international communications course, and he also taught the one seminar we had at international or international journalism. Uh-huh. And I was sort of antsy to get into the program, get into international journalism or international news flow, whatever. And one of my colleagues, Scott Cutlip, did you ever know him?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, he had pretty close ties with history, people in history, and he suggested to me that I should talk to Phil Curtin about this new African Studies program,
uh-huh.
And so he arranged that we should have lunch, and I can remember the time that it wasn't too long after that I had lunch with Bill Curtin, and I think Vancina was there, John Vancina, and I, and Bill Curtin was very interested in having somebody in journalism and in the program, you know, and it was a great opportunity for me. I mean, I was really impressed with the way the university could operate, you know. I remember that there was a $4 million grant from the Ford Foundation.
Yes,
that was sort of the basis
For development of area studies, which Fred Harrington had been very instrumental in getting from Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the principal financial source for area studies at that time.
Mm-hmm. So it was more than just African studies.
Oh, yes. African studies was not the first. It was South Asian studies growing out of a offering in Sanskrit, and goes way back. Mm. And then the other one was Latin America, but that was initially Brazil, but then it expanded.
Mm-hmm.
We had some work in Portuguese and Brazil.
Yeah.
So they preceded just by a year or two African studies, which got going in 1961-62.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember that my first year teaching at UW, you did sit in on my class in African politics.
That's right. Well, and here again, I was impressed very much by Phil Curtin's way of getting things done, you know.
Yeah.
And he decided, well, I obviously needed some coursework, and so he arranged that right away, and there was no applications made or anything, but I was to get the next semester off. And I was to audit courses, and so I audited his course in history of Africa, audited your course in African politics, and I think I was in Herb Lewis was teaching a
seminar. He came in the same year, yes.
Yeah, he was teaching. I was sat in on his seminar, and I think the summer before that I had taken a African geography course that was taught by a visitor, but. But then he got me, I suppose, from the graduate school, a semester research leave that he wanted me to go to Africa to find acquaint myself with. And he had suggested, he said, I should go to Africa and visit several countries and go to a place that's of French origin and one of English and maybe one in East Africa and so forth, and so I did, you know, and Harvey and I went, and we ended up visiting about six or seven places. We went to on that first trip. We went to we stopped in Egypt on the briefly, just partly as a. Because you had to go through Egypt to get in from, but we went to Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, and back to Paris, and so that sort of it was a once over lightly, that was a real introduction to Africa, and and I guess that was from UW funds.
So you then began to offer courses.
Yes, that's right.
Related to Africa.
That's right. After I had come back, we offered two. We already had these two courses: international communication and a seminar in international. And then, so I started a course, African media, but I called it a mass media in developing nations, but the main focus was on Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a seminar in that same area too, so that was the way the course offerings, at least in journalism, started. So that,
and you had some flow of graduate students, as I remember a couple of Nigerians.
Oh yeah, that's right. I had. It's in the longer version of my vita, but I had 12 master's theses of African students, mm-hmm. and 5 PhD students, mm-hmm. that all had African topics. Uh-huh. Some of them were not. A couple of the PhD students were not Africans, but mm-hmm. At that time, we were getting a flow of African students that were coming in,
right?
And a number of them had, they started to show up in my classes, mm-hmm. A lot of them were from Nigeria or Ghana, I think, but they were interested in journalism too, they had seen that book I'd written as a result of the first trips through Africa. Muffled Drums had a great deal of interest for the African students because they'd never seen anything that had been written about the press in Africa or even of their own countries. And so that was a...
So Muffled Drums came out of that very first trip to Africa?
The second trip. In 1968, I remember in African studies meetings, there was you folks somehow had access to a Fulbright research grant, mm-hmm. and there was somebody who was going to take it, but he couldn't take it for some kind of a, I can't even remember the guy's name, and I don't think it's anybody who stayed longer, but. So this grant was sort of up for grabs, and I said, "Well, I can do that."
I'll take
so, it. So that's when that was in 1968, and it was 2 semesters, and Harvard went with me, and we took our 2 kids too, which was kind of interesting. But then I really visited all the nations that I really were covering in the book. Mm-hmm. So I was I'd been gathering information about media in about 8 or 10 countries, both Anglophone and Francophone countries, and my research methods were not very good. You are not very sophisticated. But, you know, I've been hearing stories that you had to get, in a lot of the African studies, if you're going to study in a new country, you had to have a research program, and you had to get it approved by the authorities and so forth. Right. And I heard these horror stories, you know, that anthropologists were now becoming sociologists because we don't have any primitive tribes, but my method was really just sort of based in part on journalism. I mean, I would go into a place like Kenya, and I would go to the embassy, and meet the local press officer that was dealing with the media. And that person would be very, very informative, and he would introduce me to, or at least give me the names, or set up appointments to meet the local editors, and then it would sort of fan out and meet more of the journalists, and I never really said I was writing a book or anything. I would just say I'm studying the press. I want to know about your newspapers or what your conflicts with the government are, and so forth, mm-hmm. and with Harvard, and also I should emphasize that Harvard always really worked very close with me on all this, and because she was an experienced journalist and very good at interviewing, and also she spoke French, and I didn't know any French, and so enabled us to go to the Ivory Coast and Senegal and then on that trip, the 68 trip, she was also, she was gathering information for her African cookbook. She even wrote, I think, wrote one of the first African cookbooks.
Right.
And each country she would, when I would do another thing, she would pick up any cookbooks that were in print, and you soon learn that, you know, nothing is ever copyrighted in cookbooks. But then she'd meet a lot of people, meet them. Food experts and so forth, and so she was gathering that information. And then after we came back, she wrote
Cooking Safari.
Yeah, Kitchen Safari was the name it came out with. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was it was a very good book.
It was. I still have it on my cooking.
Oh, is that right?
Shelf.
Yeah. You know, it was a good book, and it was also one of the first. And the it suffered the fate of not staying on the market long enough. You know, Anthoneum was the publisher. It was a good publisher. Mm-hmm. But they, not too long after it had been out, maybe 6 months or so, somebody saw a whole stack of them in the Barnes & Noble stores that being remaindered, you know. And whereas the reputation continued for a long time, but it was not available. But anyway, that was the way we were... That became the way we did it. And
Muffled Drums, in part, appears to have grown out of an earlier interest in freedom of the press. And you did publish, I guess your first book was on Supreme Court decisions on freedom of the press.
That's right. And that had been freedom of the... And also, at Minnesota, I had studied constitutional law, and a very good guy named Harold Chase... And he was it was a year-long course in constitutional law, and in the and also I had become interested in press government relations mm-hmm. so that I'm in my PhD program I minored in political science, mm-hmm. and I had to take two fields in political science, and one was constitutional law, and the other was political behavior, mm-hmm. An interesting kind of a side point that had written prelims in the political science for my minor, and I had to have I think it was something like a 4-hour written exam for both constitutional law and political behavior, and just before I sat down to do it to write it, I asked, can I use a typewriter, and I said, oh sure, you can use a typewriter, and they sort of put us in separate little booths. Well, I was close enough to journalism experience that I was really fast with a typewriter, really fast, and I could think on a typewriter, and so that I turned out reams of material, even though I wasn't particularly learned, but it was one of those, and I passed with flying colors, whereas I was worried if I had to write it out longhand, that would have been a different case, and then... And I've been writing slower and slower ever since. That's one of the things that newspaper experience can do for you. That
you also have published on South African press and under the apartheid regime. Mm-hmm. That came after Muffled Drums, right?
Oh yeah, right. And that came. That was a later experience. I had met. I think it was in around 1974. I was invited to give a lecture at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, and they were dedicating a monument for the 1820 settlers, well, the English that arrived then, gave a talk. I think it was talk on the South African press as seen from abroad. And at that time, I met a fellow, Tony Giffard, Anthony Giffard, who was then teaching at Rhodes. He later got a PhD at University of Washington in English, and then later joined the faculty at Seattle, became the director there at the school. But Tony and I started this collaboration, and then we and later we had decided we did the book on press and apartheid, and he had he'd had working experience with that, and so that was that's where that came out of. From, yeah.
Now, one of your books, The World News Prism, has a remarkable degree of immortality to it.
I
noticed that it's out in its sixth edition now.
No, we're
maybe more.
That's right. We're now thinking of the ninth edition.
Ninth edition, my goodness.
But, you know, it's I had written it as a small book and without any idea of a textbook, but it kept doing pretty well, you know, and they said, and that was the Iowa State Press, and they published it for several editions, and the Iowa State Press was having problems, business problems, and so they decided to sell their business to Wiley Publishers, because they were publishing a lot of technical agricultural books, mm-hmm. And so Wiley bought them, and then Wiley also picked up Muffled Drums, and then by this time it was getting use as a textbook, and the thing of it was the technique of about every 4 or 5 years I would revise it, but I would put a great deal of emphasis on new information or new developments, and so that it tended to make the book more useful and here's the I've got a copy of that, and also we've tried to keep it from being too thick. Uh-huh. But it covers kind of a global view, and it's also takes into account a lot of the new information technology, the role of mm-hmm. computers, satellites, and so on.
So I can see that it covers quite a landscape: changing ideologies of press control, digital media, globalization of media, and regional chapters on the Middle East, India and Africa. I can see why it has acquired the capacity to be updated regularly and stay on the market.
Yeah, and so it's become kind of a hobby for me and a couple of editions ago, I guess after I retired, publishers are kind of reluctant to have retired people as the only author, and so that, so I took on a co-author, Jim Scotton, who has a PhD from here and has taught at Marquette for some years, but I became very much interested in South Africa, in part because you know it's a country of under great onslaught, you know, and we went into it very early, mm-hmm. and we got to know, we made some very good contacts, mm-hmm. particularly with the Rand Daily Mail, mm-hmm. which was the really great newspaper in South Africa that you know was the consistent opponent to apartheid for many years, and it was the only white newspaper that was widely read in the black townships, but And so we made a number of friends that were in that, and particularly and also I wanted to mention that there was one experience we had, Harvey and I had, that in 1978, we were invited by the State Department, or USIA, really, to come and do a 1 month course for black journalists in South Africa, and it was something that the South African government didn't like at all. They were very annoyed about it, and this course was to be co-sponsored by the Catholic Bishops Committee or whatever, and it's a Catholic religious group, and the man at the head of that, it was a Catholic. He wasn't a bishop, but he was pretty high up. He was a black South African, and he wanted to do this, and he was do this course. And co-sponsor it with the USIA people in the State Department, and but he was banned at the time, and so however we met him at a restaurant, and where the management of the restaurant and all knew all about this and were sympathetic to him, and so he came had a long lunch with us. Uh-huh. and discussed the course. Well, we did this course, and it was for three and a half weeks, I guess. But it was just a great experience, because you know there were a number of black journalists at the time who were working. There were several publications that were intended for the blacks, several of the papers like the Randale Mail and others used blacks as stringers, because they could get stories that the white reporters couldn't get, you know. Mm-hmm. But these people, I've got a picture of that. Well, this was the class these people were all working in journalism, but they had no training, you know, and much less an education, and they just loved it. You know, I mean, they just loved doing this course, the people in the state in USIA arranged to get their number. There were several American correspondents who were active in South Africa at the time and were working, and some of them actually were freelancers, but they were good reporters. In fact, they would come and lecture to the class, we didn't have any typewriters or anything, but they would write out the stories, but Harvey and I would grade them, and it was just a really marvelous experience, because they really appreciated it, you know. And it was about 5 years ago, I got a call from a correspondent in South Africa. I think it was a British correspondent or something like that, and it said that they had just talked to so and so, who was a very active in anti-apartheid politics and so forth. And this was about 10 years ago, and that this person had said that how much they appreciated this course. You know, it's not that we taught them so much, but you know, but they had a sense that they were getting some professional help. You know, so that was a very nice kind of a little.
Is there anything else that particularly stands out in your memories about your African field work experiences?
Yes, another one that is that this occurred in I got it right here. The about 1985, there was a coup in Sudan, and I can't remember the name of the man who'd been the despot leader for many years.
Nimeiry.
What?
Nimeiry.
Nimeiry?
Yeah, and Nimeiry.
Oh. About that time, about 1985,
he was overthrown.
Overthrown. And so there was kind of a period where there wasn't any government, any particular
actually
dictator.
Actually, he was overthrown in 83, and then there was an election in 85. And then in 86, I think it was, the elected government was ousted by the current leader, Bashir.
Oh, yeah. Well, in any case, there was kind of a interim period when there wasn't a... the dictator hadn't been... Nimeiry had not been replaced. And so they the State Department had asked Bud Nelson, who's my colleague and is also Bud, had written a press law book and was kind of an authority on it. But Bud couldn't go and suggested that we go, that I go, and so the State Department said wanted me to go, and so Harv and I went for about 2 weeks in '85, and it was really a real experience to go into Khartoum at that time, because we. We didn't have much to go on, but they wanted us to come so we flew in. You had to, at that time, and I think you flew to Cairo from London to Cairo, and then you flew from Cairo to Khartoum. But it was about the middle of the night. I think we left about 2:30, and before we had gone in. At the airport, I had bought a bottle of pinch bottle of scotch, and at the Cairo airport, and I had that, and I was sort of carrying it in my hand, and so then we arrived about 2 a.m, and we were supposed to be met by the USIS guy, and nobody was there. We were completely alone, you know, and so we finally. Finally, took a cab to the I think it was the Hilton. There was a big Hilton hotel there that for the foreign travelers, and it was a really pretty modern hotel. And they, but we, so then the next morning, the USIS people belatedly caught up with us, and they should have been at the airport to greet us. And then they said, and I said told about our experience, and also said that I had brought this bottle of scotch because I've heard that it's hard to get any liquor in Khartoum, and then suddenly the public affairs officer was aghast. He said, "You mean you carried that into through the airport and nobody stopped you?" Because it had been about a week before that they had very ceremoniously poured all the liquor into the Nile from the
that
they could.
Nimeiry, yeah.
Yeah, after Nimeiry, and so they said, and they had already kicked out a couple of businessmen that whom they found had liquor in their possession, and so they said go back and get rid of that, lock that bottle in your suitcase and don't show it but at that time, but it was kind of amusing that you couldn't get any kind of liquor, but they had these sort of soft drinks that were very elaborately prepared, you know. And when we, but And the only place you could, the, they could serve liquor was at the U.S. Embassy, and so that the local people were quick to. But anyway, we had we met people with the news service and the government information agency and so forth, and talked with them and had discussions, in fact, had the Minister of Information was sitting next to me in one of these discussions at a table, and his breath just reeked of alcohol. I don't know how, but it was an interesting time, they were also they about halfway through our meeting they said that they'd received some death threats toward American about Americans. And they offered to let us have us leave early, but we decided we wouldn't. We'd stay, and although they did cancel part of our program, we were to go to what's the other town across the river from
Omdurman.
Yeah, Omdurman. We were supposed to meet over there with some students, and we didn't do it. But it was a fascinating time to be. Be there and
yeah. Let's talk a bit about your career in the Department of Mass Communications. Was that a congenial environment for you? Or what did you find to be the, as you look back, the strengths and, if any, weaknesses in the department?
Well, we had a very very good program. I think that in those years that the 30 years I was in this school, and because there was a very good balance between people that were some traditional journalists and who had strong professional experience. And incidentally, you know, the fact that I did not come directly from journalism into Wisconsin... It was not a disadvantage. It was important to have in those days. It was important to have had professional experience. I mean, that was considered a plus for any faculty member. But our department was very well balanced in the sense it had people that were, law and history as well as the newer quantitative research that people like Jack McLeod and Steve Chaffee that were both really outstanding people in the field and. I think that the school was. I think because everybody sort of thinks about themselves, but I think we had in those years one of the best balanced programs in the in the country. There was a certain amount of friction between quantifiers and traditional people, but on the whole, I think it was a harmonious group, and I think Ralph Nafziger was really a marvelous person, and he was very much influenced in getting Bud Nelson. Bud Nelson was his successor, and then I followed Bud as director. I was director for 5 years from 75 to 80, and. So I think I always felt it was a pretty harmonious program.
How about your contacts with the African Studies program?
I particularly in the early days, I was really kind of fascinated with our meetings because all these interesting people my first meeting I can remember. It was sort of a typical meeting that we would meet in a table in the corner of Tripp Commons, and I remember Marge Harris would be there and Phil and Fred Simons and Aristide
Zolberg
and Van Sina, I think too, yeah, and and that was pretty much what it was, and of course Phil was. That was a pretty active period, but I enjoyed the meetings very much because particularly the foreigners, you know, that, you know, the who there was one guy, name I've been trying to remember. He was a I think he was a political scientist from Britain, from
Wilfred Whiteley?
Yeah, I think that's right.
He was a Swahili teacher.
Yeah.
He was an African language and literature.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit later, replacing him was another Brit, Lyndon Harries.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also Swahili.
Yeah.
Those are the only British.
Yeah, I remember that Whiteley had gone. He had gone since the last meeting. He had gone over to Tanzania and had a meeting, and he was saying that he was on the campus of the university at Dar, mm-hmm. and he had said that while I was there, the army had gone out, had not, it sounded like a mutiny, but
mutiny,
they,
yeah.
This is just an anecdote, but that I remembered. And he said, I was walking around that evening, and a British soldier came up, and he said, if you see any of these African soldiers on the loose out here, take their guns away from them and tell them to go back to the barracks. but there was a lot of just fascinating stuff that and who was the South African Joe
Jordan
yeah, I was really liked him very much, and mm-hmm. and he had a lot of, but I felt the camaraderie was very nice, and at and I didn't really do too much collaboration as far as any research, but
I recollect two or three decades ago a conversation with you about a project that UNESCO at the time was promoting for a new world information order.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And as I recollect, you had some involvement in the response to that project, or the critical response that came from the Western journalist community.
Yeah, that's right. That was a big issue for several years. That mm-hmm. Involved international journalists to a great extent, and to Western-oriented journalists or newsmen, they felt it was a this effort to have a new world information order was an essentially an effort to get rid of all any opposition.
Muffle the drums.
That's right, and it became a big issue in the more socialistic. And at that time, you know, the Cold War influences were really very strong, and you had the I remember John McNally, who was a colleague of mine, John has had experience with Latin American journalists and is very able to teach him. We used to in our class, we used to give a debate. We would both take two sides, have a class debate about the New World Information Order, and then invite the students to comment or raise questions and so forth. And that was really very, very effective way to deal with the subject. And
At that particular moment, nearly all African states were under authoritarian rule. So were most Latin American states. So were the bulk of Asian states.
Yeah.
Above and beyond that, you have the Soviet bloc.
Mm-hmm.
In any international organizational milieu like UNESCO, where government representatives are casting votes, then something that a project like this that was move to curb information media, as I recollect it, were provisions for licensing journalists.
Mm-hmm.
You could imagine how that was going to be carried out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It gradually just died out, But I want to tell you, I had one interesting experience that was not directly African studies, but it really gave me an introduction into African journalism. And it was also my one run-in with the CIA, which my daughters were very mad at me over. but this happened. Ralph Nafziger had after World War II, the State Department asked him. He was on a group that helped look at the German press and made recommendations on which newspapers ought to be encouraged to develop and others to let them die. So he was invited. This was just about the same time I was involved in journalism with the African studies, that he was invited to teach a class in Berlin. It was an organization that was set up with the called the Mass Media Institute for Mass Media in Developing Nations, and he did the course for the first time. It was about a 2 week, maybe it was a month course. At least it was a month course, and he went to Berlin and taught a number of African students.
Uh-huh.
And then it was repeated a year later, and he said he wanted me to do that, go, because he knew I was interested in Africa. So we went. This was the semester after I had the special courses, and which were in the spring, and in the fall we went to Berlin. Uh-huh. Harvin, the kids and I went to Berlin, and we taught this group. It was 13 African journalists.
Uh-huh.
And this was all. This was at a time when new African states were deciding which way they were going to go, east or west, And so that we taught these about 15 journalism students, and they were there for a month, and it was a very fascinating experience, there was one little problem with the. There were two journalists who came from Egypt, and they were sent there by Nasser, and it turned out that these guys that were they were in our class, but they were reporting back to the Russians or the other side of the wall, other side of the Anyway, we taught, and I met, and also when I, later I met several of these people as I went through the round trip through Africa, in Nigeria and Kenya and others, I found out later that this program.
Okay.
Several years later, there was a television documentary about was the church committee made a member of the church committee made in
CIA accesses.
Right. And when they rolled the credits at the bottom, they listed these groups, and they said the Hobby Foundation of Houston, Texas. Oh. Well, that was Hobby was Mrs. Hobby was the she owned a newspaper, but she was in the army women's army group, but that was also a front group for the CIA. Well, the thing about these kind of activities could have been handled by the State Department openly without But they were so afraid of McCarthyism, McCarthy's influence, that they were.
So you retired in 1989.
Right.
And anything you'd like to say about your retirement activities?
It's kind of hard for me to understand why I really kind of cut off African studies at that point. You know, I think that partly because of my journalism influence, that I sort of feel that journalism is what's happening today, and I felt I was losing touch with the field. And I remember a well-known professor, chemistry professor, I can't remember his name. He was asked why he didn't do any research after he stopped teaching. And he said he couldn't. He said, "I can't do research after I stop teaching because I'm not keeping up with the field." Mm-hmm. And so my interest then tended to deal with this area, and also I wrote a small book on recent criticism of the press. I've kept pretty busy, but I've had problems walking increasingly, uh-huh. and it makes it very difficult for me even to get over to the campus, you know, and that's been a problem of my involvement with even getting over to meetings and so forth.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that we should get into the oral history record?
Well, I think that I think the university, I mean the speed or the efficiency of establishing the program was very impressive to me, you know, it was more than just Phil Curtin, but it was
a unique moment in university history when funds were going up.
Yeah, yeah.
When enrollments were going up.
Yeah.
When my colleague Bill Young had persuaded the state to move to an enrollment-based funding system, which
mm-hmm.
in those years was very favorable to the university.
Mm-hmm.
Sales tax was introduced in 1962, a new revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
So there were then also the Title VI program. There were a whole series of things that made funds for very rapid expansion possible in mm-hmm. a way that would be out of the question today.
Yeah, and the universities were all expanding, you know, that it was a good time to go into the...
And then Phil Curtin, you were absolutely right in underlining his entrepreneurial spirit and aggressive pursuit of building this program.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and he was really very nice to me, you know, very, very courteous and
he was a wonderful guy.
Yeah, he and I went together to an African studies meeting. We both were on the same plane and we sat together, and I just had a great opportunity to talk to him, and he was just a very
a remarkable scholar. He and Von Zina between them
gave
an initial core of strength to the program that
mm-hmm.
was crucial in establishing its national reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Ready to wrap up?
Yeah, I think that I've...
we're pretty well covered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this concludes the oral history with Professor William Hackton.